The Guardian.
Welcome to Guardian Football Weekly, the podcast that asks the biggest questions in the game. This week, Mourinho doused in milk as City win at Old Trafford. Did someone mistake him for a bowl of Honey Nut Loops? Everton claim a point in the Merseyside derby. Was that the most predictable outcome since Blue Planet ended on a downer? As a penalty is given, we ask, are referees bad? As a penalty is not given, we ask, is diving good? That and other burning issues like Harry Kane, four-season wonder, and David Moyes. Maybe not that bad, actually. You also get a chance to win a Toshiba TV. It's Guardian Football Weekly in association with Treadstone. So, here we are back in the pod. I'm Paul McInnes, sitting in for Max Rushton, who's standing in for James Richardson until that other podcast he's doing goes tits up. Alongside me, we have the Kylo Ren of the Guardian Sports Desk. It's Barry Glendening.
Hello.
We have Dutch football expert, Dutch language expert, and the only person I know whose Twitter avatar is a Vermeer portrait with a bulldog photoshopped on top. It's Priya Ramesh.
Hello.
Hello there. And finally, it's writer, reporter, director, corporate lawyer and former boyfriend of TOWIE star Cara Gilby, who was sent to prison on drug charges, although some of those may be other Daniel Harris's. It's Daniel Harris.
Daniel Harris's, I think, is the plural.
But Daniel Harris's. Don't hold it against me. Good to see you all. We're going to start off at the big match of the weekend at Old Trafford, where Manchester City set a new Premier League record of 14 consecutive victories with a 2-1 win over United. But it later emerged that some equally tasty action happened off the pitch as Jose Mourinho, yes, innocent little Jose, wandered into the opposition dressing room to complain about his noisy neighbours and ended up getting doused in water and milk. What started as one nice man just asking for a little respect ended up with a 20-man scrap, Mikel Arteta getting his eye busted after Romelu Lukaku threw a bottle at him in a transparent attempt to finally make himself useful. Baz, your thoughts on whatever you want to pick up from that?
Well, I suppose we should probably start by wondering who Romelu Lukaku was aiming the bottle at, because it almost certainly wasn't Mikel Arteta, given his current run of form. I just can't get this lovely image of Jose Mourinho wandering around covered in milk, looking like, you know, the money shot of a special interest movie.
A very, very, very special interest. Yeah. I'm not ruling it out existing on the internet, but it would be very special.
It's very unsavoury. We're obliged to say that there's no place for this kind of thing in football. I just wish it had happened at Man City. The game had been at the Etihad, because, you know, what a treat for the people in the Tunnel Club that would have been. It seems wasted to have happened at Old Trafford. But disgraceful scenes, but more, please. I wish this happened more often.
Daniel, you are a Manchester United fan.
Yes.
What do you make of that result and performance?
Not that much, I think. I guess the bottom line ultimately is that City are better than United, and the game reflected that. And if we were to start talking about why, the first reason in the end is going to be, if you were to take it back to first principles, is the difference between the Glazers and being the PRing of a repressive oil regime. And we're here to talk about football and fighting and special interest movies, not about that. But it would be irresponsible of us to say, to go on without saying that, because...
Net spend, though, I looked at this. Net spend, you're basically on $500 million over the past 5 years.
I'm not United spent loads of money. It's nothing to do with that whatsoever. But then I think the next big reason as to why that would be the difference between the sides is, if you look at what Jose Mourinho inherited, and if you look at what Pep Guardiola inherited, there is a big difference. Jose Mourinho inherited a genius goalkeeper and two promising young players in Marcus Rashford and Anthony Martial, and I think he probably would have happily thrown the rest in the bin. Mm-hmm. Whereas Pep Guardiola inherited David Silva, one of the greatest players ever to play in England, Sergio Aguero and Kevin De Bruyne. And I'm not saying at all that what he's done with them isn't brilliant. We know that Guardiola is an amazing coach when he has the best players, because we've seen it at Barcelona and we've seen it at Bayern Munich. And though we also saw that on the pitch yesterday, he improves players. But I think that what Mourinho has done with this United side is, there's been progress. He's got rid of some bad players. He's bought some good players, not uniquely good players, and they've been better this season. Yesterday, they were rubbish, and it's hard to necessarily know how much of that is on Mourinho, who sent his players out with some instructions, and how much of that is on the players panicking, which they definitely did.
I want to come back to you on that. Priya, what was your reading of the actual match and where it was won and lost?
Well, I mean,
One of the stats that really baffled me with this game is the City, I think, had more shots on target in this game than they did against teams like Huddersfield, West Brom, Leicester, Brighton and Everton. And the thing is, before going into the match, we knew the approach United would take, and we expected a close contest where United would try to keep them out as much as possible, limit them to playing, you know, kind of passive football in their own half. But none of that happened. It was very kind of, as Daniel mentioned, I'm not sure whether that means Mourinho's plan was wrong or whether it was just not executed properly. But I mean, on the whole, it just wasn't one of the better United performances we've seen this season. And part of me thinks, is that because Mourinho kind of started off the season playing, you know, with a team that was set out to play really good, expansive football, and then midway through kind of, you know, decided to go back to being, you know, cautious and having a safety-first approach. And in the middle, his players have been caught in a confusion of not knowing which approach to take.
I might even add to that mix, they went away to Arsenal and they did that job, and they will also be able to play with a bit of flair. And so maybe they started thinking, well, actually, we can play a bit. You know, he put out a more attacking looking formation that we can go out and do that job and play with, express ourselves a bit more. But they just got mugged off.
I'm not sure it's exactly the formation. They were playing the 3-5-2 against Watford and Arsenal, and brilliant going forward. But against Manchester City, if you play three at the back, so you've only got one man wide on each side, then with wingers and who stay wide and fullbacks who come past them, you're going to get absolutely ruined. So Mourinho changed his formation, I think, not to go at City, but in recognition of the way that they play. Mm-hmm. And what you saw was instead they got ruined through the middle, mm-hmm. because they're missing a player. And it's not, you might say it's not right that Paul Pogba not playing makes such a big difference, but he makes a huge difference because he's the only player in the United team who can link the midfield, who can link the defence and the attack. And I don't just mean with what he does, even in an attacking sense. He can carry the ball forward, or he can hit long passes. And what you saw instead was Marcos Rojo belting it at no one. And it's not just the fact that would allow United to attack, but it gives the defence some respite if when the ball gets clear, it doesn't come straight back. And what you saw was United conceded two rubbish goals from set pieces. That's not a fluke. That's pressure. That's frazzled minds who've been defending for 40 minutes, last-ditch defending. It's not particularly surprising that when the goal comes, it's not a belter from the edge of the box, but it's a scruffy goal because people stop concentrating because it's hard.
Romelu Lukaku, Barry. It was his unfortunate clearance that sort of sliced straight into Chris Smalling that was turned in for Nicolas Otamendi for the winner. But lots has been made of his isolation up front and his inability to do much with the ball when he actually received it. Do you think he's having a hard time? He's not scoring goals. How much of that is on his broad shoulders?
Well, I suppose if you're a striker who isn't scoring goals, it is going to prey on your mind. I think he seems to be getting quite a lot of criticism he doesn't deserve. He probably deserves a lot for yesterday because, you know, he was sort of responsible for both goals, his individual errors, and missed a sitter by blasting the ball straight at the City keeper or straight into Ederson's face when, you know, it was the only possible place he could put it.
Saved with the tat.
Without scoring.
It was like Klitschko taking one off Joshua, yeah. Wasn't it? He just like straight up on his feet and at it again.
But, you know, I don't think he's been playing as badly as people claim. He's been providing assists. And yesterday he was just so isolated. There was, you know, Daniel's talking about the formation that Mourinho sent his team out to play in, and you know, it seems a bit weird just to even talk about formations when they're just camped back in their own area, making no effort to win the game. And if you do a freeze frame on your TV, you've got 10 Manchester United players in their own penalty area, and then this gulf of space to Lukaku standing on the halfway line. You know, and it must be frustrating being a United player just to know that your manager has so little trust in you. That he, you know, I don't trust my players to win this game, so I'm going to, this is the strategy we're going to use. It's probably the correct strategy, but you know, you see Alex Ferguson sitting in the stands. What does he make of this? Manchester United letting someone come to their stadium and just boss them like that.
He would do that if he felt it necessary. The game where United effectively lost the league in 2012 was at City, but United, they didn't play quite like that because there was a bit less of a gulf between the sides at that point, but he did do that.
But he wouldn't do it at Old Trafford.
I I think that Alex Ferguson, he liked great football, don't get me wrong. He's still a pragmatist who liked winning, and he would do what he thought he needed to do to win, and he built the best teams, so he rarely had to play like that. But I think the situation with Lukaku is a difficult one, because United lost Ibrahimovic in the summer, and that's 29 goals, I think, gone from a team that doesn't score enough. So you need to sign a centre-forward to replace him, and you're thinking, right, well, who is actually available? And there's Belotti, maybe, Lukaku.
Alvaro Morata.
Okay, Morata, let's say Morata and Aubameyang. So you're thinking, who is the most likely to score the number of goals that you need to score in the Premier League? I can see why he went for Lukaku. As a United supporter, Lukaku was someone I never particularly rated watching him play for Everton. He wasn't someone I wanted. He wasn't someone I thought would improve the football that United would play. But I totally understand why Mourinho went for him, in a way that when Guardiola signed Gabriel Jesus, he could do that because if it failed, if it took him time to adapt, or if he was rubbish, he already had Sergio Aguero.
Yeah, for sure.
Mourinho had to think, what is the most guaranteed goals that I can get? And I totally understand why he went for Lukaku.
He could have played Marcus Rashford up front. I mean, you know, that's another option they had. But I don't want to get too much into this because, you know, we're talking about United a lot here, and we're not really talking about City, who are now record holders. They've won 14 matches on the bounce. They're 11 points clear at the top of the table. They are playing some just superlative football, but they're also playing with an attitude. You know, they tore into United on the press yesterday. They played physically. You know, David Silva looks a robust, you know, terrier of a player in the middle of the pitch now. That bit where Guardiola tears the Santa hat off Mangala's head as he's warming up. You know, there's a real sort of Premier League steel about this team as well. I mean, it's difficult not to be impressed by them. Hey, Priya.
I think on David Silva, he's always been that kind of player who you would never think he's dirty, but he secretly is. he is just that player, just on the surface, like, all grace and elegance and everything, but always has that bite to him and will get stuck into a fight of it if he has to. I mean, City just look like champions. I mean, not to put that in a sense of the Premier League title being over, which it effectively seems to be, but they just play with that kind of confidence that we never saw from United yesterday. And I think that was a stark difference between the two sides. This is a team that's top of the league and their nearest contenders. And there was such a gulf in not only the quality, but also how they approached the game and how much, I mean, I hate you using this expression, but how much they wanted it.
A couple of quick stats here. Most points in a 38-game Premier League season is 95. It was Chelsea in 2004 and 5. Who was the coach for them? I can't really remember. After 16 games in that season, they had 39 points. City have 46. Most goals scored in a 38-game Premier League season, 103. Chelsea in 2009-10. Is that Ancelotti?
Ancelotti. Well, yeah. But that was like 7-0 against Wigan rather than the constant regular pummeling of everyone, which is what City are doing.
After 16 games, they'd scored 40. This City side have scored 48. Does anybody think the title race isn't over?
No, I think it's well and truly over, because the teams below City are so inconsistent. They will continue to take points off each other, lose occasionally against opposition outside the top six, and you can't see City dropping too many points. I mean, they'll probably lose the game at some point, but they're not going to, you know, that gulf will get bigger rather than smaller. I'm just curious, Daniel, as a United fan, like, the one time they tried to play yesterday, they scored. Would that suggest that perhaps they should be more proactive, or should have been? I know it's easy to say the benefit of hindsight.
It's not so much the benefit of hindsight. I've seen this game before when United played Barcelona, and you look at Guardiola's Barcelona team, and you think that defence is rubbish. But the problem is getting at that defence, and particularly, as I said, without Pogba, United lack the wherewithal to get the ball from back to front. And in the course of 90 minutes, you're going to manage it a couple of times, and when you do, Otamendi, I know he's improved. Kompany is old and dodgy, and the fullback, Delph's not a fullback. So when you actually can get there, you're going to look like you're going to be able to score, because they're not good at defending. But it's the fact that they defend from the front and all the other cliches about pressing and this, that and the other, that it's actually getting the opportunity to get at them is hard to do when you don't have defenders who can pass the ball out well, and you don't have a ball carrier in midfield. And United have ran into trouble against these teams before.
One consolation Daniel was taking at the beginning of this podcast was the hope that Manchester City might get a tough draw in the Champions League last 16. Didn't happen. They've drawn Basel. Man United, meanwhile, have drawn Sevilla, apologies to all our Spanish listeners. But we've seen Sevilla in the Champions League already. That probably is not going to scare Mourinho too much.
No, I don't think Mourinho will fancy himself over two legs against most teams in Europe. And I think that the standard of football in Europe at the moment is that there are no teams, I don't see any teams, who I think are close to the best teams that we've seen in the Champions League era. So that's, but there are lots of good teams. So there should be loads of great ties. And when it gets to the last eight, you'd expect that most of the best teams will be there. But I think, yeah, it's hard to pick a winner at this point for that reason. But yeah, United would expect to get by Sevilla, and if they can't, then they don't deserve to be anywhere near the final stages.
You expect City to get past Basel as well. Although one word of advice to Pep Guardiola: beware of Ricky van Wolfswinkel. On to the second big derby of the weekend, and that was Liverpool against Everton at Anfield. It ended 1-1. And from my point of view, it was almost the platonic ideal of an equaliser conceded by a Klopp side against a Big Sam team. Everton had created absolutely nothing in the match. Liverpool had dominated, been wasteful in moments. Maybe they could have created more clear-cut chances, but they did have a couple of clear-cut ones that they spooned up. And then one big long ball into the box from Rooney. Dejan Lovren puts his hands up, baby hands up, and all of a sudden it's a penalty and Rooney converts it. Barry, was that written in the stars?
No, I think Liverpool should have won that game comfortably. Jurgen Klopp got criticised for his team selection. You know, it did raise eyebrows before the game. It wasn't just people criticising him, you know, after the event. But I think that team was more than good enough to beat Everton. They could have gone 2-0 up if Sadio Mane hadn't been quite so selfish and squared a ball to, I think, Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain, and Mo Salah were screaming for the ball in the box, and he selfishly chose to shoot himself and missed.
And Salah put a header just past the post.
Yeah, and, you know, Sam Allardyce, he went with a plan. I wouldn't say it worked particularly. I'd say more got away with it than anything else. He had no interest in trying to win the game, and it would have been very funny if they had won the game. But yeah, fair play to Everton for getting a draw they almost certainly didn't deserve. The thing I'd maybe criticise Klopp about, apart from his churlish manner in which he conducted his post-match interview, but I think he apologised eventually.
And his teeth.
His substitution seemed a bit weird. Sadio Mane wasn't effective, but he left him on and took off Mo Salah, who's always dangerous and scored a good goal. And maybe he should have, you know, rather than rest Coutinho this game, or Coutinho, Firmino, maybe rest them against West Brom tomorrow, or, you know, have taken them off earlier in the game against Spartak Moscow when, you know, there was no need to leave them on as long as he did. So his game management I would criticise rather than his selections.
But I do think that the blocks, the headers, the positioning in the box, you know, Liverpool play some brilliantly slick football. They can carve any defence open, and they were robust, Everton. So I think you've got to give them credit for that.
The defending was outstanding.
Yeah.
What do you make of the penalty might have been soft, as they say, but it was undeniably a push in the back. That's a penalty. And yet,
that's Lovren on Calvert-Lewin.
Yeah. Lovren and Henderson, their complaining was so vociferous. Klopp was adamant after the game it wasn't a penalty. In his press conference, he asked for a show of hands as to who thought it was a penalty. Bear in mind, it's at Anfield. A lot of the press are Liverpool. The vast majority agreed it was a penalty. And I think he was quite surprised by that. I want to know what goes on in his head and Lovren's head and Henderson's head that makes them appear to genuinely think it shouldn't be a penalty.
Egomania.
Do you reckon?
Yeah, like I perceive the situation in a particular way because I'm involved in it and I don't think I was doing that. It's very easy. If you think about when you tell a lie, it becomes quite easy to convince yourself quite early on that the lie that you're telling is correct because that enables you to do a better job of telling the lie. And it's to do with thinking that things revolve around you and your perception of things is the way that things are. I saw it in a different way with Allardyce. There is no greater sight in football than Sam Allardyce after a win, after a point like that, where he is about to devour himself and perform all sorts of special interest movie acts upon himself.
He's removed that vertebrae.
And it's the, I feel it's sort of like the other side of the same golden spinning bed.
One thing I would say to counterpoint to that, it could also be the first stage of grief when you're absolutely in denial. Liverpool, they're in the last 16 of the Champions League, and they've drawn Porto, who had a very impressive qualification from their group. So that should be an interesting encounter too. West Ham 1, Chelsea 0. And again, we're looking at squad management, I think, particularly with relation to the Chelsea. But first of all, I want to ask, what has Moisey unleashed? He's, you know, been in there, what, four games now? And it was, I think it was a second half performance after they got turned over in the first game.
He's unleashed the Juggernautovic.
Oh, there we go. But I mean, it was, I think it was like, I was looking at the app on Saturday afternoon, the Premier League app, and sometimes, you know, you want to look to see who's got the assists. And I had to keep strolling down because there were so many yellow cards on the West Ham side. But I think he's told them in this, in a particularly progressive way, to run some more and tackle a bit harder. And that appears to be working.
Well, I think their big problem under Slaven Bilic is that they just weren't fit enough, which seems remarkable. You know, you would think at a Premier League football club, the very least you could expect is that your players will be fit. And, you know, it's difficult to know how much time Moyes or his fitness coach have to work on that with, you know, games coming thick and fast. But I was sort of interested and curious to see how they'd get on or how they'd fare, say, in the last 10 minutes when you'd expect them to flag. And there was no sign of that. The defence was very well organised, good goal. And, you know, before Stoke shipped five against Spurs, West Ham had the worst defence in the league. And Moyes seems to have sorted that out. You know, they showed signs of life against City in defeat in a game no one expected them to get anything from. And that was a good win for them.
Chelsea made only one change from midweek in the Champions League. We're talking about Liverpool making a big rotation, but Conte went for a very small rotation. Was that the right decision, Priya?
Yeah, this is the other side of the coin, because Klopp got a lot of stick for, you know, changing his side too much, but I'd argue that Conte probably lost a bit more by not changing his side at all, essentially. And you could see that, because someone like Cesc Fabregas, like, he can put in a great 90 minutes once a week, but he's never been the fastest, never been the you know, the paragon of stamina. And to expect him to kind of produce, and because he is essentially the only other player in that team who can offer some creativity other than Hazard. And on Saturday, it was just so painful to see how Chelsea were so dependent on Hazard in the final third. And for all that's been kind of thrown at Lukaku in terms of his first touch, essentially, Morata wasn't very good on Saturday. There was that shot of Batshuayi on the sideline getting a hot water bottle to warm his face. And it
classic
was
modern footballer there, wasn't it?
I loved that bit.
We'd see the
but I was just thinking, why not bring in Batshuayi? Because you didn't really play him against Atletico. Let him play for the reserves, I believe.
Fresh from his goals in the under-23 league in the Czech trains.
And then you bring him back into the side on Saturday, and then he doesn't get a minute when you're clearly struggling to get goals. You need something else. And he has done that before. He did that against Watford, I think.
Late goals is kind of his thing for
Chelsea. Yeah, this is really baffling to see Conte kind of change. He started with Bakayoko, took him off at halftime for Pedro.
He did nothing. He was awful.
That also kind of got me thinking about, like, is he worth the money to, like, you know, let someone like Chalobah or Loftus-Cheek go and then bring in Bakayoko, who isn't necessarily offering a lot more than they would?
Baz, I just quickly want to, hopefully you've been texting your real football men pals. What did they make of the hot water bottle incident?
I would imagine all right-thinking individuals were absolutely appalled. I watched one of the games on Sunday with an 86-year-old neighbour who was absolutely outraged at the number of players who were wearing gloves. I won't repeat what he said. It's a family show. But yeah, suffice to say, he was decidedly unimpressed.
I don't get this. Honestly, don't get this. It's cold outside. When you play, I play Sunday League, and like, I would not dare play without gloves in the whole of December. And it's, I think it's perfectly acceptable for footballers to have to, like, you know, look after their own body, basically, and their health by keeping warm.
I don't think that's looking after their health. I understand that they want to be warm, but I don't think that putting a hot water bottle on your face or wearing gloves is looking after your health. It's looking after your comfort. And for me, as someone who watches football, when I pay to watch football, I want the players to be suffering. Like, I remember I went to watch United win the Champions League group with CSKA Moscow. I was aggravated that the game was in the early part of the season because I wanted the players to suffer. I want them to be cold. I want them to...
No, sorry, carry on. I'm just going to say what you have an awful lot in common with Antonio Conte, Daniel.
The thing with Antonio Conte, though, is he has gone and kept himself warm with his new hair. And I think, therefore, that's a bad example to set to the players. And is it any wonder when you see Antonio Conte walking around with, I don't know what you want to call it, with a parka on his head, that the players themselves also behave in that manner?
So blame the Belgravia Institute, right? In the Champions League?
One thing about Conte, he's complaining about his players being tired. He's not rotating his team much or his squad. And yet he constantly moans about the fixtures and how many Chelsea have. It's getting very wearisome.
I think he made a boo-boo, Conte. I do think it's on him, this one. Right, in the Champions League, Chelsea have drawn none other than Barcelona. That is going to be a tie and three quarters. Finally, in part one, it's the game I was at the weekend at Wembley, Tottenham Hotspur 5, Stoke 1. Daniel Harris, is Harry Kane as good as Alan Shearer?
I think the difference between them is, if we talk about Shearer Mark 1 before the first injury, which I think is the only really proper great version of Shearer that there was, Mark 2 and Mark 3 were good, but they weren't equivalent to the top.
So remind me when he got this injury.
He got the first injury at Blackburn, and then the second, and he was that level of Shearer, which I think was the Shearer that was as good as some of the best players we've seen in the league.
You're a 96 level.
No, it was before then.
Oh, right.
It was before
okay,
then.
Wow.
Blackburn, I think that... Kane is a smoother technician, and Shearer had the change of pace that Kane doesn't have. And I thought, for Kane's second goal, what we saw was actually what Lukaku doesn't have, was that ability to shoot early and with precision. Whereas Lukaku tends to just whack it as hard as he can, like very low percentage finishes, Kane immediately sizes up what he has to do and does it really quickly before the keeper has a chance to set themselves. And that is... That will never go, and so that the lack of pace doesn't make so much difference in those contexts. And I mean, he is a similar player to Shearer, actually. And so, is he better than Shearer? I would say not yet.
As good as was. I'm only wanting to. I wouldn't put him past Shearer. Shearer's done it all, but he does, apart from
doing it in Europe.
Yes, true. I think the interesting thing for me was it's the fine margins thing that this has been a lot of. Spurs' problem this season has been getting that first goal. It was only the second time at home in the league, Liverpool aside, that they scored a goal in the first half. And once that happened, then they can sort of, you know, they have a bit more space. They thrive in that.
Stoke, I would be worried about, I have to say. Mark Hughes, you'd have to think he's on borrowed time. I mean, they're an absolute shambles. And I'm surprised more teams don't score more than, you know, 3, 4, 5 against them.
Well, it was quite funny because it was quite obvious at the halftime they were 1-0 down and they probably should have been 2 or 3 by that point, because after Spurs got the goal, they started ramping up. And Stoke come out the second half immediately on the front foot trying to get back in the game. And it's from that sort of offensive play that Spurs rob the ball. Harry Winks over the top, Dele Alli assist, through for Son, and it's 2-0. And I asked Hughes about this, you know, what was the game plan at half time? And he said, you know, it was absolutely to give us a platform to stay in the game till the end so we might be able to scrape an equaliser. To do anything else, to go gung ho, would be ridiculous. But that is precisely what his team did, which makes you think, well, what's going on there? The gap between what the manager is apparently telling the players and what the players are doing on the pitch. I mean, they sometimes look like the worst sort of Premier League thing, which is a collection of talented, expensive individuals who can't play as a team.
I think they're averaging like just a fraction over a point a game this calendar year, which, you know, at absolute best, you're just treading water, and at worst, you're going to go down.
Spurs have got Juventus in the last 16, which is another tasty little tie, I think. And just before we leave this part one, a lot of the comments under my match report saying not enough credit to Son Heung-min for what a great player he is.
I think actually he's changed the way that Spurs play, because one of the problems with Spurs is that they've lacked a bit of variety. They have a way of playing and it works really well and everyone knows their jobs. But what they've got now with Son is they've got a bit more pace and variety up front, someone who can run across the line. And also, I think if Dele Alli is going to be the player that he has the talent to be, I've always preferred him a little bit deeper. I think playing as a number 10, he has the ability to score goals and make goals, but doing very little else in the game. But he's got the real attitude and zest of someone who needs to be involved in the game a bit more. And I think he's got the ability to do it. And if he's going to utilise absolutely everything that he's got, him playing a little bit deeper with Son and Harry Kane in front of him will make him a better player and it will make Spurs a better team.
More of a number 8, you think?
If we're going to... what is a number 8?
Sort of a Brian Robson-y sort of up and, you know, anyway.
Brian Robson was number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11. Yeah, okay. But yeah.
It's probably a good time for Eriksen to get a goal as well, because he's had a bit of a rough patch recently. So going into, you know, December and then the Champions League new year.
He got a rest in midweek, you see. Got a rest against Apoel. So that was actually good squad rotation, I think, on this, because they won. It's all in the proof is in the pudding. Anyway, end of part one. We'll be back very soon with part two. Welcome back to part two. Before we get stuck into the rest of this weekend's Premier League action, I want to draw your attention to a competition. Open quotes. Football Weekly fans, this week is the second week of our Toshiba Big Draw competition. The wonderful people at Toshiba have said they will give us 3 super duper 55-inch 4K HD TV screens just in time for Christmas. Listener Kieran bagged the first TV last week, so we have 2 more to give away to win this week. All you have to do is check out Max Rushton's Twitter feed, at Max Rushton, and do your version of his superb podcast Stickman drawings. The best, the wittiest, will win a Toshiba TV and get to live and breathe all your Christmas sporting action with HD. So make a Rushton stick drawing of this edition of the podcast and email it to footballweekly@theguardian.com by this Wednesday midnight. 2! To read the terms and conditions and to find out more, go to the blog for this show on theguardian.com/podcasts. Again, competition entries must be emailed by midnight this Wednesday, 6th of December, to be considered. And sadly, this is a UK competition only. Close quotes. Back to the football. Okay, so into part two, and we're going to start with Southampton 1, Arsenal 1, a late equaliser for Olivier Giroud after Charlie Austin had opened the scoring. Was there anything surprising about Arsenal not failing to get 3 points away, Daniel?
Not really. Partly because Southampton are a good side now, and they were playing some quite pretty football previously, including Charlie Austin, and now he's scoring goals. And it also wasn't particularly surprising to see that Arsenal's defence was dodgy and early on as well. I think even when they played Huddersfield reserves and they won 5-0, in the bit before Mesut Ozil took over that game, their defenders, when they were put under pressure, were clearing the ball low and clearing it directly to attackers, and a half-decent team would have beaten them that night, I think. And that was more or less what happened again yesterday. And you saw Arsene Wenger after the game saying that he thought that the United game was in the minds of his players, which was quite curious, because after that game, he'd basically suggested that his defenders had had the evening off. So I'm not quite sure which of those two things is true, but no, long story short... Thing. Arsene Wenger, very good at the back.
Arsene Wenger changing tack to suit his narrative. Shocker. Where do you see Saints at under Pellegrino right now, Priya?
I think they're more playing in his style and in his image than they were a bit earlier, where they seemed quite a bit flat and at times a shadow of the side they used to be under Koeman and Pochettino. And that kind of carries on from last season, I guess, where they were just really, really dull. But I think having Austin back and in form is really helping their fortunes. Dusan Tadic had a great game yesterday, I thought, with the assist especially as well, playing it from that angle to Austin, who made that very clever run behind him. And I think we're finally starting to see a side that is gaining some sort of collaboration on field and playing with some understanding. And I was really impressed with Pellegrino's use of the formation, basically, because they played as a three-man defence when they didn't have the ball, and what Prowse would kind of slot into right wing back. But with the ball, they went into a kind of 4-4-2 or 4-4-1-1, with Watt Prowse obviously pushing back up into midfield and Stevens coming out to right back to cover that. And that is something that they managed to make it seem very, very simple, whereas, you know, in reality, it's not that easy to actually bring into effect.
So smart players then?
Definitely, definitely. And I think we've kind of had that feeling about Southampton for a while now. Someone like Ward Prowse for a few years now has been on the fringe of, you know, will he make it as a top player, or is he just destined to be that kind of mid-table perennial in the Premier League? And if he puts in more performances like that, and the likes of Stevens as well, and I thought Yoshida had a great game, Tadic was very, very impressive as well.
No, that's very interesting. But because I mean, I always thought with Saints, you know, the thing is that they've got ability, but the idea wasn't always there. And I think having Charlie Austin in the team, somebody who's just going to play up front there, and you can feed him the ball, and he has a good conversion rate. That sort of gives them a bit of identity. I want to move on to round out the big seven, which is Burnley, who beat Watford 1-0 after Martin Ziegler was sent off. Bads, Burnley have the same number of points as Tottenham, and they've both played 8 games against the rest of the top 10. I mean, that basically means they should have been in the Champions League draw themselves by football maths.
I wouldn't go that far, but they're worthy of their lofty position in the Premier League, one which no one expected them to get. Personally, don't think they will stay there. You know, Lars Sivertsen has made got great traction out of slagging them off in here, saying they're in a false position and that their stats show they shouldn't be as high as they are. But
what about the stats that shows how many points they've got?
Yeah, and after 16 games, that's just sort
you'd
of
have to ask Lars.
I think the kind of point that Lars is also making with that stat was that they have got the points now, but don't expect it to necessarily last. If it does, I mean, well and good for them, but if they do taper off, that won't come as a big shock because their stats of underlying.
Are we talking about XG here, the fact they give up good chances?
I would think so. Yeah. I would think it is the fact that you will have a regression to mean, the fact that some teams may not take their chances against Burnley, and that's no disrespect to Burnley, who I think are quite an amazing team in the way they're put together by Dyche. But it's just that if they do taper off, that won't come as a huge surprise.
I think this match was a big test for them because Robbie Brady was injured. He's out for the season almost certainly. And Scott Arfield came in for him and scored, you know. So that's a good sign of, or a good portent of things to come. Arfield's sort of a fringe player there. He has a chance to nail down a first team spot, and he's got off to the best possible start. Kevin Long came in as well for Ben Mee, did well. So they're showing they've strengthened depth as well as a good first team.
A quick question. Marvin Ziegler, would that be a weird name even in Dutch?
Ziegler, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
People
definitely
will be like, whoa, that's Ziegler, he stands out.
Yeah.
Good.
Ziggy Stardust.
Hey, fantastico. Perhaps one of the most controversial moments of the weekend came at Selhurst Park, where Christian Benteke, who's been without a goal for some time, decided that the last-minute penalty, 2-2 against Bournemouth, was his moment to break his streak, seized the ball. He wasn't the appointed penalty taker. Milojovic had already scored the penalty in the game. Benteke steps up, misses it. Has anybody got any sympathy for him in that situation?
I don't think it's hard to find sympathy for anyone at any point ever on a football pitch, because one of the things you enjoy about football is the way it tests people in a particular way. And because it's not real life, it doesn't really mean anything. It's enjoyable to watch people fail. And so that was, I enjoyed that with regard to Benteke. Totally understand why he wanted to take the penalty. And my favourite bit of that game was actually Bournemouth's first goal, which came from that rehearsed short corner where it looked like it was so rehearsed that they'd even practised the fouling. And when that happens, I think you only have to stand and applaud. And then what I enjoyed afterwards was Roy Hodgson talking about how angry he was. And he said, we were furious. And I thought, I would absolutely love to see what that looks like. Roy Hodgson being furious. I'm sure it's terrifying.
I think he might delegate it to Ray Lewington at some points as well, the actual fury.
Apparently Hodgson does go off in the dressing room and is quite fearsome. It's difficult to imagine because he's sort of teddy bearish in disposition. But yeah, I wouldn't have any sympathy for Benteke. It's 870 minutes he's played now without a goal this season. And he didn't score in Palace's last match last season either, so it's even longer than that. But I don't understand why his teammates let him take the penalty. They clearly didn't want him to. I spoke to a Crystal Palace fan who was at the game on Saturday evening, and he was just laughing because he said when it became apparent that Benteke was going to take the penalty, no one in the stands wanted him to take it. His own teammates didn't want him to take it. You know, Tompkins was gesticulating furiously. No one on the bench wanted him to take it. And then he took it, and it was so bad. You know, it wasn't a good save. It was just a terrible penalty.
So what happens in that instance is suddenly sort of like mental images of his price tag start flashing up, and it's like, oh, he's the £35 million striker we've got to give it to him.
That is actually a thing, because you look back to Fernando Torres at Chelsea, and there was a point of time where you just didn't want him like even near the ball. And at times it seemed like he didn't want to be near the ball, and he'd make all these runs out wide whenever, you know, his team started to play a bit forward. And I think that definitely does come into factor. And just 870 minutes, that's a long time.
It's like they say, don't get between a hippo and the water. And I imagine that is why no one took that ball off Benteke. If you've got a hungry centre-forward who hasn't scored for a long period of time and there's a free shot or goal, then to actually go and get the ball from him would be quite a dangerous activity.
Well, it's quite odd, isn't it?
The thing is, he didn't have it in the first place. Milijevic had it. And Milijevic was preparing to take it, and then Benteke went up and, you know, had a discussion with him. It wasn't like he wrestled the ball off out of his possession.
What do you think he said to him? I know something about you, and I'm going to tell everyone.
So I suppose you have to kind of applaud his courage.
It's like
for taking it when he's in such a poor run of form, but golly, you have to score if you're going to do that.
No, absolutely. Maybe it's like one of those moments where somebody walks into a department store, puts on a fur coat and just walks out with it. It's just everyone's like the gall of it.
Hodgson post-match, I think, was like, Benteke's the kind of guy who's going to think about that disappointment and want to come back even stronger. But I do really feel for his confidence at the moment.
Yeah, exactly. Not think that. About that and come back even weaker.
Yeah.
Especially after you've been attacked with a Paolo Coelho novel in the dressing room.
Swansea City 1, West Brom 0. The word from South Wales is that Paul Clement will keep his job until the January window now. As long as they're in the mix, he'll be given cash to spend. Another goal from Boney. Renato Sanchez not even on the bench. But Pardew's second game and this sudden inversion of the Pulis principle, going from playing no strikers to playing all of them, where he had Rondon, Rodriguez and Hal Robson-Kanu on the pitch at the same time, doesn't seem to be working. Out of those two teams, I suppose they could both go down, but which team more likely at this moment in time?
I would say Swansea. My only concern would be that the traditional sort of Pardew effect hasn't kicked in, and you know he everyone knows he starts well and then, you know, arcs and then plummets. So that would be a concern, I suppose. West Brom, they didn't show much sign of deviating from Pulis principles in that game. They offered nothing going forward, so that was kind of a surprise, particularly given the three-pronged attack he played. And it wasn't really a very good game, but a good win for Swansea in a game that probably could have gone either way.
I would hope that it would be Swansea that went down, mainly because West Brom have the Vine Pub, which is probably one of the greatest football pubs in the country, with an amazing indoor kebab cooking device. So the Premier League, in my opinion, needs
like
the Vine.
Like a big charcohol grill.
Yeah, but indoors. Oh. And
Does it have one of those sort of massive chimneys that sucks the air up?
Yes, and I also once saw a girl in there wearing a dress made out of patchwork West Brom crests, which I also thought was
That's
amazing.
Dedication. That is dedication.
And so for that reason, I hope West Brom stay up.
Great reason. Newcastle United 2, Leicester 3. Quite a topsy-turvy game this, although I think over the course of the game, Leicester were the better side. 3 wins in a row now under Claude Puel. Seems to be sort of making them the sum of their parts. Ibora and Didi look look handy in the middle. He's making good use of Albrighton and Mahrez in the forward three, and you know, Jamie Vardy still being Jamie Vardy. Newcastle, meanwhile, Rafa's moaning looks to have been a premonition of things to come.
Well, they've lost 6 out of 7 now. And in that run of 7 games, they're conceding an average of 3 per game. They've dropped 11 points from winning positions this season, which is more than any other Premier League side. So I thought that squad, despite Benitez's moaning, would have enough about them to stay up, in that there would be 3 teams worse than them. Not that they'd be particularly brilliant, but yeah, this is a worrying slump they're in.
It's anti-Benitez as well, because you'd expect if they went 1-0 up at an early on the doors, you know, they'd be able to sort of stay compact and hold it together.
That's the hallmark of Benitez sides, is that they're usually defensively quite solid and you know, manage to get these small wins and that is it. But they're just strangely permeable at the back.
Do you think, I think you look at Florian Lejeune and he looks a little bit sort of slow on the turn and exposable to pace as he was on Saturday. But do you think there's something, can the off-the-field uncertainty affect the team on the pitch, do you think, Daniel?
It's hard to know. I mean, sometimes you think it's impossible not to if players hear things. Like when you hear managers talking about lots of games and players being tired, I feel like often you're giving them an out because everyone's had a job and you all know that in that job you often find yourself looking for excuses. And when that kind of thing permeates a club, you think that it probably does make a difference. And then the other part of you thinks, well, the players just like playing football and playing PlayStation and whatever else they do in their spare time and enjoy themselves. And do they really waste their time thinking about that kind of thing? And I guess the answer to that is I don't know. But one of the things I do absolutely love about Newcastle is the return of the red numbers, which I remember from the very first Newcastle side I remember that had Waddle and Beardsley and Kevin Keegan in it. And also from the Glipton Giants, made famous in Jossie's Giants. I think it's just the black and white stripes and the red numbers looks great, and I would let Newcastle stay up probably for that.
I also enjoy, in terms of their defence, just, you know, spending a moment thinking about it, the return of Jamal Lascelles will be a factor now, because they've lost him to injury over the last few weeks, I think.
Yeah, a couple of months, I think.
Benita said after the match yesterday that just having someone there to offer that leadership and shout and organise things does help, and I think that may mean that Newcastle might be a bit stronger at the back with him back in the side.
I don't think the off-the-field uncertainty would affect the players. I think what might affect the players is constantly hearing their manager tell everyone that they're not good enough to stay in the Premier League. And he's probably right, but you know, you can't really fault them for effort. They are putting in shifts for him, and the fans aren't unhappy with the players. They're unhappy with their owner and his, you know, team of spivs working alongside him. I don't think any of them are unhappy with the players. How long that will last, you know, they're working hard. I think maybe they're just not good enough.
But maybe a miasma of bad vibes. Daniel?
I also want to go back to Leicester. I think that the job that Claude Puel has done there is exceptional. And if you think about the aggravation that was generally flying around, obviously in the terrible and major parts of the internet, as he was, who is this amateur getting the job? I think we needed to remember that he took he took Monaco to the French title, he took Lyon to a Champions League semi-final, he took Southampton to a League Cup final where they outplayed Manchester United. The guy knows what he's doing, and I think when you mentioned...
They deserved to win that final as well, just based on how good they were playing.
They did play a lot of really tedious football, and he was... I remember the first game at Leicester, it was against Southampton, and all the Southampton press boys were... No, sorry. I was at Southampton match, but Leicester was on the TV, and all the Southampton press boys were kind of like, oh God, look, here he goes. He's actually doing some exciting football. I think even people inside the club felt that it was a tedious and just not an exciting place to be.
It can take time to... Depends on the players that you've got and to get to grips with the new league. But I think you mentioned all Leicester's attackers, and the one that we didn't mention was Damari Gray, who Craig Shakespeare never trusted. And he's made a massive difference.
Absolutely.
Because you've got someone who is unpredictable, and sometimes that can be hard to play with if the teammates aren't quite sure what he's going to do. But if the teammates don't know what he's going to do, then you can be sure the opposition doesn't. And he gives them some penetration and something unexpected, because when Leicester won the league, everyone knew what they were going to do and no one could stop them from doing it. Whereas with a player like Damari Gray, it's not that you know what they're going to do, it's that you don't know what they're going to do. And that's just a different version of a similar attack. And I think he's made a really big difference.
Takes the heat off of Riyad Mahrez a little bit as well. Final game of the league. Sorry to cut you off there, Priya. We're just Huddersfield 2, Brighton 0. Your thoughts?
I thought it was a pretty decent game in as much as both teams played pretty well. And I think either of them would have deserved to win or at least draw. And I think it's great that Meunier came back into form and got the brace, obviously. And these are actually two of the promoted teams I've really enjoyed watching this season. And I said on an earlier pod that they might not have, like, you know, the... as I think Jonathan Wilson or someone was saying about how they lacked kind of the story that something like, you know, a team like Leeds would bring. But I quite like... both the kind of vibe around both these clubs is quite positive, with Wagner and Houghton kind of bringing that togetherness at each of the clubs.
And they're both really well organised as well, and both in very similar form as well. That's the first win in after four straight defeats for Huddersfield, and now Brighton have gone five games without a win.
And so, some impressive recruitment as well. Someone like Pascal Gross, Aaron Moy. So they've managed to kind of build a really nice, really likeable team at each of their clubs without having to, you know, spend extortionate amounts.
Unfortunately for both, I think Huddersfield host Chelsea, who'll be burning, and then Brighton go away to Spurs. So, yeah, best of luck to both of them. Into the Championship, and it's a special Championship moment because Wolves have been running away with this division. Was there anybody who could stop them, especially at Molineux? Any plucky side, perhaps underrated by the entirety of the country and the world? If there was that side might have been called Sunderland. And they played them on Saturday, Baz.
Yeah, they played them. I fully expected them to get thrashed. I said that on Thursday, and I was mistaken. And they got a point. Wolves have been reined in. And Lee Cattermole was sent off. All is well in the world again.
At least there's
the
something.
Natural order has been restored.
Fantastic. Elsewhere in the Championship, Bristol City continue their great run of form. They won an injury time at Bramall Lane, and they're now in third, and the Blades are in sixth.
That was a very good game, actually. I watched that on Friday night. Yeah.
So what's the secret to the Bristol City sauce? Because I haven't seen them play this season.
I don't know, to be honest. Yeah, I that's the first time I've seen them. Just hugely impressed with them. You know, whether they can keep up that head of steam or not, I don't know.
Well, kudos to Lee Johnson anyway. Nigel Atkins started with a win for Hull against Brentford, and my beloved Norwich City won for the first time in nine games. In League One, Wigan are now 4 points clear at the top after a 2-0 win over Fleetwood. Shrewsbury still in second, Blackburn in third. Whereas Charlton were celebrating 25 years back at the Valley, and I'm not sure whether they slipped the fixtures computer some cash, but on the anniversary they played the same opponent, Portsmouth, that they played in the first game back at the Valley. 25 years ago they won 1-0, on Saturday they lost 1-0, unlucky. And in League 2, it was 1-1 between the top two sides. Luton and Notts County, while Harry Kewell...
For whom show that Amiobi scored the equaliser.
Fantastic. That's a great story. And because they've got the Jorge Grant as well, as this guy is tearing up. So they must have one of the most fearsome attacking lineups in the lower leagues. And it was also a rare win of any kind for Harry Kewell's Crawley, who brought Mansfield's 7-game unbeaten run to an end. And that is the end of part two. Welcome back to part three. We're going to do a quick tour of the continent now, and where better to start than Spain? And on the line, it's Sid Lowe. Hello, Sid. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, I'm not bad, not bad. So, La Liga, top four all won. Who did the best work this weekend?
Well, I mean, I suppose in a way, and this is going to sound ridiculous, right? But the team that got dominated for most of the game, the team that only had 24% of the possession, their lowest ever total in La Liga since these things were being totted up by various clever people, and a team that only scored one goal and scraped one goal victory, are in a funny sort of way the team that I feel like people have kind of changed their minds on the most, and that's Atletico. Mm-hmm. Atletico went to Betis, were kind of overrun. It was very, very definitely a kind of a clash of styles. This idea that Quique Setién, the Betis manager, is very much a kind of a purist, and Simeone is very clear in his style, but of course from the other end of the spectrum. And the reason why I say that this game has been picked up on as somehow meaning something, because in a way you could sort of argue, well, it doesn't mean anything. You know, they were just very defensive. They got away with it. They won 1-0. They're a bit lucky. But this is now a 20-game run without being beaten for, sorry, a 19-game run without being beaten for Atletico Madrid, which is a club record. It's 20 games in a row on the road not getting beaten. In other words, an entire season's worth of away games not getting beaten. And there's just that kind of ominous sense that, all right, they might not be all that good. And they might not be that great to watch. And it's true that they've dropped points because they've drawn games when they really shouldn't have done. And it's true that everything that happened with Carabag in the Champions League kind of conditioned the way that we look at them. But now, having broken this record and having with that feeling like a kind of a threshold, people are suddenly going, hang on, could Atletico Madrid actually win this league? And obviously, you know, on the weekend, as you say, in which the top four all won, and I think in which we kind of wipe out Sevilla as a candidate, because if Sevilla had won at the Bernabeu, they would have gone ahead of Real Madrid. In a weekend in which Madrid finally played really well, scored the lots of goals that they've not been getting all year, in which Barcelona went away to Villarreal, a really difficult place to go, 1-2-0, in which Valencia needed a slightly ropey penalty to win. And you say, all right, all four of these are serious candidates, but it feels like the thing that's different in our minds on Monday morning, it feels to me anyway, and maybe I'm allowing myself to be kind of impressed by this, is Atletico Madrid. And given that Costa's due to come at Christmas, you start thinking, they could actually challenge for this title now.
Quick question about Atletico, because I want to ask you about Real Madrid as well. Will they take the Europa League seriously?
I think they will, but I think we'll probably see them do... I mean, quite apart from anything else, that Cholo Simeone is an extraordinarily competitive man, and his mindset is always to compete, even at times maybe when he shouldn't. And I'm still one of those people. Now, I know it's easy to say this after the event. You have no idea, you know, how the season's going to pan out. But you look back to that season when they won the league and lost the Champions League final. I still look back at that season, look at January and think what Atletico Madrid should have done is throw the Copa del Rey. Now, obviously, it's very easy to say after the event, but they don't, and it's not in their nature to do that. So I think they'll take the Europa League seriously. The last time they were knocked out of the Champions League group stages, in a group that had Chelsea in it, they went into the Europa League and won it. And that was kind of the beginning of this Atletico era, in a way, this sense that, wow, we can really win things. And I think they will, but I suspect they'll take it seriously in a way that a lot of teams take it seriously, in a way that perhaps Man United did last year, which is to kind of go through the rounds, rotate a lot, maybe not play your strongest side, and then suddenly find yourself in the quarterfinals and think, all right, here we go then.
Real Madrid won 5-0, as you say. We want to know a bit about Ashraf Hakimi, who scored the fifth. What can you tell us about him?
Well, he's a Moroccan right-back who's actually the first Moroccan to play for Real Madrid. Who's played, I think that will be maybe his sixth game this season. He's played a fair bit because Danny Carvajal had that heart problem. And he's very quick. He's quite aggressive. I think he looks like he's going to be a very good player indeed. Obviously, he's not going to play a huge amount with Carvajal in front of him. Scored at the weekend and admitted he didn't really know what to do. I mean, he certainly knew what to do when he was one-on-one with a goalie and took it very well, but didn't know what to do in terms of the celebration. And I think he's a player that like a lot of the players that come through from the youth system at Real Madrid, certainly in recent years, it's possible that he won't play a really, really central role with Real Madrid. But I think he'll have a part to play, and I think he'll be a useful member of the squad for them. You know, look at Nacho, who you know, we talk about Nacho almost as a kid who's come through, but he's 26 now.
Wow.
Not young, but he's useful and he plays well every time he plays. Danny Carvajal, who's become very, very good indeed, had to go to Germany and come back and kind of use that almost as a finishing school. And I think Ashraf looks like he's going to be a useful member of the squad, as I say, with Carvajal there. Don't expect him to play a huge amount, but he will be at the World Cup in the summer.
Fantastic. Right, one quick final question. Champions League draw is in. Sevilla have got Man United. Barca have got Chelsea. And Real Madrid have Paris Saint-Germain. Who's got the best draw there?
Manchester United have. I look at this now and I kind of think that there's a chance, possibly the first time that I can remember. I mean, there's bound to be an occasion, but there's a chance when you're looking at this round of games at this stage of the competition, the first knockout round after the groups, and you think there is a chance that none of the Spanish teams get through. Now, obviously, there's a chance that they all do. But I think Real Madrid, obviously, by February may look a little bit different. I think they'll make a couple of signings in the winter window, which could, of course, have some impact on them. Barcelona should look a little bit stronger by then because, of course, Dembele will be finally fit and able to play. But, you know, they've got very, very strong sides. And there's a slight hint of those two not quite convincing this year. And as for Sevilla are a very weird team. As I say, if they'd beaten Real Madrid this weekend, they would have climbed above them in the table. They would have been in fourth place. They've got good results. They, of course, had that amazing comeback against Liverpool. But the truth is, you watch Sevilla, and particularly this weekend, and you think, they're just not that good. And you know, things may be different by February, but I feel like that's a pretty favourable draw for Man United. And you know, you look at this, and of course you go back over the group stage thing, and you realise yet again that finishing first or second, yes, it can be beneficial, but it needn't necessarily be beneficial. You know, Paris Saint-Germain blow everyone apart in the group stage until that final game against Bayern Munich, and they get Real Madrid. Bayern Munich finished second, and they've got a somewhat more favourable draw, and so it's not necessarily a guarantee of anything. But yeah, it looks very tough for the Spanish, and there's a very, very conscious, I think there's a very strong awareness this season now in Spain that the English clubs are getting stronger, that they're finally using, you know, they're finally using that their money. Resources, their enormous resources well. And I think there's a genuine concern in Spain now that English clubs are very soon going to overtake them.
Yeah, well, on that pessimistic or optimistic note, depending on which way you're looking at it, we'll say thanks very much, Sid. Enjoy the rest of your week. Now, moving eastwards to Italy. Surprise me, Barry. Goals galore?
There were quite a few goals, but there were a lot of draws. And I think the big fixture of the weekend was Saturday's Derby d'Italia between Juve and Inter. And it was a damn squib. Finished scoreless. Wasn't a very good game. Inter remain unbeaten at the top of the table, but Luciano Spalletti was quite disappointed after the game and said he didn't think Inter had done themselves justice, didn't take the game to the Juve in the manner they should have, and suggested maybe he thought his players were a bit overwhelmed at the prospect of taking on Juve. And he said, you know, we should have gone in with a more positive approach. We're top of the table. Juventus had the better of the game and probably should have won. Mario Mandzukic missed quite a few chances, pumped the crossbar with a header at one stage. Elsewhere, you know, Napoli drew, Roma drew with Chievo, AC Milan won, beat Bologna 2-1, so that's sort of a first win for Rino Gattuso, who's sort of still in caretaker mode.
I think people were at the sides of that match counting the number of players who were in short sleeves and not wearing any gloves to look for the Gattuso effect, and I think it was quite widespread.
I think someone tweeted that Gattuso at one point was like, shout it to his players, if you don't win or if you don't hold on, think about what I'm going to do to you during the week. And held on for their lives.
I thought that the Juve-Inter game was actually a kind of classic Serie A game back from the golden age of Serie A, where it was 0-0, but
really bad.
I didn't find it a terrible game. I thought that it was
The tacticians amongst us.
No, not even that. It was just like what you want from a game of football. For me, like one of the main things I want is intensity.
Yep.
And I thought that we had that. And like the beauty is can come later, but is it compelling? Is it intense? Do I get the impression that something amazing or strange or horrible or violent or whatever might happen? And I felt that in that game. And I think that that is something that I would always look for in a game of football.
Just to acknowledge, we already said that Juve will be playing Spurs in the Champions League. The Serie A's other qualifiers for the last 16, Roma, have been drawn against Shakhtar Donetsk. On to the Bundesliga. Priya, you are going to be our Bundesliga correspondent this week.
I am.
We're just quickly on the Champions League. Bayern have got perhaps, they got the Ryan Babel draw. They're playing Besiktas. And how did they get on in the league this week?
So Bayern won at the weekend, surprise, surprise, with a header from Arturo Vidal. And yeah, nothing particularly notable that about that game, apart from the fact that Bayern now have a healthy lead at the top of the Bundesliga. Yeah. Yeah, normal service resumes in Germany as far as that goes. But the crisis baton has been handed over to Dortmund, who have actually been struggling for a while now. Their last win in the Bundesliga came in September, 30th of September, I think. And their only win since was in the cup against a third division side. And so they got rid of Peter Bosz on Sunday. It was a bit of an odd appointment as well in the summer because they failed to get their first choice, who was Lucien Favre, who was with Nice. So they basically just went to the same agent because Favre and Bosz have the same agent, and ended up getting Bosz, who obviously had that really impressive run with Ajax last season. As a man, Peter Bosz apparently got on very well with inside the club, but as a head coach, his ideas didn't particularly translate very well onto the pitch. And he has very kind of different ideas about fitness. So Dortmund didn't do as much as they used to in terms of physical work over the summer and pre-season. And that kind of showed in the first half of the season, where they're always usually brilliant in the first half and then tail off in radical fashion. They just seem so tired after like around 60, 65 minutes. And that's when they end up conceding. The game against Werder Bremen at the weekend. Werder Bremen are, if I'm not wrong, in the relegation zone. And if you didn't actually know who was playing who, you would have thought Dortmund were the relegation threatened side. That's the kind of confidence with which Bremen were toying with Dortmund in the Westfalenstadion, in their home. So they've gotten rid of Bosz, who the funny thing that I kind of off topic, not related to football, but Bosz lives in a house in Dortmund, which was rented to him by a guy who became a millionaire selling ringtones. But the irony is, in Bosch's house, the phone service is terrible. So I don't know, maybe that's a kind of weird premonition of how this tenure would end.
He rented his house from Crazy Frog.
Axel F. So Köln played against Freiburg. Köln, who recently got rid of their manager, Peter Stogler, who has taken over Dortmund already. But they have not won yet this season. And they were actually leading 3-0. The game was delayed half an hour because of the snow. And whilst it was snowing, apparently Köln were playing Freiburg off the park, led 3-0 at one point, and then in the most dramatic fashion, as the snow began to melt and the sun began to shine, Köln melted away with the snow. They lost their 3-0 lead, ended up losing 4-3 with a penalty in the last few minutes.
Fantastic, and beautifully poetic there at the end as well, actually. In France and Ligue 1, PSG got back to winning ways as they won 3-1 over Lille. Angel Di Maria, Javier Pastoria and Kylian Mbappe with the goals. The top four all won, in fact, with both Monaco and Lyon leaving it late. Monaco were 2-0 down after 70 minutes, which is kind of in keeping with their form this season, I guess. At home to Troyes before coming back to win 3-2. And Lyon were 1-0 down until the 79th minute, when 19-year-old midfielder Hussein Aouar scored twice to take all 3 points. Okay, well, I think that we've done pretty much. Baz, you don't have anything from the Slovakian league you want to add, do you?
No, I'm keeping that information to myself.
Good on you.
Is that a new podcast about the Slovakian league?
Well, exactly. I think there's diversification a go-go with Max away. But anyway, I think that brings this week's events to for a spicy little close, a snowy little close there. I'd like to say thank you very much to Daniel Harris. Thank you very much to Priya Ramesh.
Thank you.
And thank you very much to Barry Glendening.
Thank you, Paul.
For coming into the pod today. I'm Paul McInnes, and this has been Guardian Football Weekly, brought to you in association with Treadstone, the razor built for the modern operative. Not only does Treadstone send you blades through the post, it wipes your memory and retrains you as an assassin. Whether you live in Asia, Africa, or on a shipping boat in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, Treadstone will find you and do you.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.